From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Throughout the 60s, Paul Krasner merged comedy and politics. Krasner founded the satirical magazine The Realist, and he was a co-founder of The Yippies. Now in the 80s, Krasner still combines comedy and politics in his writing and in his stand-up act. Paul Krasner talks about combining entertainment and the First Amendment on this edition of Fresh Air. Also, we ask cartoonist Bill Griffith if he's having fun yet. He's the creator of the perpetually surrealistic comic strip Zippy the Pinhead. And we have reviews of the new album from the rock group Was Not Was and of the new movie Gorillas in the Mist. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. When Paul Krasner is called the father of the underground press, his response is to demand a blood test. Krasner published and edited the magazine The Realist from 1958 to 74. He described it as a magazine of free thought, criticism, and satire. Pieces that were too radical or controversial for the mainstream press found a home in The Realist. Lenny Bruce, Gene Shepard, Kurt Vonnegut, Terry Southern, Jules Pfeiffer, and Abby Hoffman were some of the contributors. Krasner also published his own interviews with people ranging from Woody Allen to Patty Hearst. In the 1960s, The Realist was a voice of the counterculture. On one of his days away from the typewriter, Krasner co-founded the radical group The Yippies with Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. Since 1985, Krasner has been publishing The Realist in newsletter form. He also does stand-up comedy, drawing on his past experiences and his current political and social observations. And he's at work on what he describes as his unauthorized autobiography. Krasner once described his editorial philosophy as combining entertainment with the First Amendment. I asked him if that description still holds.
Yes, more and more, especially since the ACLU has become a four-letter word.
Did that surprise you?
It saddens me that, you know, George Bush would say that that the Republicans are for the people, whereas the Democrats are for the ACLU, as if there was a contradiction.
The Realist has always been a very irreverent publication, and as you point out, the rate of irreverence has been accelerating along with everything else. Are you afraid that irreverence is becoming obsolete, that so many people have become irreverent that it doesn't mean what it used to?
Well, I think it's not that it's obsolete so much as that it's become an industry. But what's happened in the process is that, you know, with talk shows like Geraldo and Donahue and Oprah, the taboos have changed totally. The concepts are acceptable now, but it's been the fear of concepts and language has been replaced by fear of litigation. I'll give you an example. One of the things that put me over the edge in deciding to publish The Realist again was when Running Press published Best of The Realist, I had in the introduction a whole series of examples of how the taboos had changed. One of these was that when Dr. Ruth Westheimer appeared on the David Letterman show, she told him that he could improve his love life by varying his foreplay, and she suggested that he have his girlfriend toss French fried onion rings at his waiting erection. Now, this was left out of the introduction, and I asked the editor why, and he said, well, that's actionable. I said, actionable? It's true. He said, well, he didn't watch the Letterman show, and he wasn't familiar with Dr. Ruth. But the point is that even if I had made it up, the fact that somebody would not publish this for fear that either David Letterman or Dr. Ruth would sue, you know, for mental anguish and false image that maybe she was against fried foods, is an indication of how editors and producers always have lawyers looking over their shoulders.
Well, have you ever run into problems with that? Because you've published all kinds of very wild things. Have you ever been sued or worried about being sued?
No. I guess my philosophy is that the stuff that I publish is so outrageous that people would hesitate to sue for fear that they would be put in the position of acting as though people could possibly believe it.
You're doing a stand-up act now. Now, you were one of the founders of the Yippies, and one of the principles of the Yippies was that theater should be a part of politics, that theater should be in the streets, that life should have theater in it. Do you think that things have changed so much that theater's back in the clubs, that to do theater you have to be back on stage?
Well, I think that, again, there's so much, even with, like, the new Gong show, there's just so much...
Oh, is that back on the air now?
Yes, but a new version of it, which is even more bizarre. And so, you know, acting bizarre becomes a role model, and it's not to get on the streets, it's to get that 15 minutes on TV, as Andy Warhol said, I guess the supplement to that now is that someday everybody will be ABC's Person of the Week.
You knew Lenny Bruce and actually edited his autobiography. And I was wondering, when you're doing your stand-up, if you think of anything that you learned through watching or talking with Bruce.
Yeah, a couple of things. One was that he really tried to use four-letter words and profanity in general for accuracy of character, not for shock value, really. And he would try not to end a punchline on a four-letter word because he didn't want that to get the laugh. He wanted its context to be appreciated. And the other thing, even more important, is that Lenny said that he was part of everything he indicted. And that's like a credo for me because it makes me not act superior to the audience or inferior either.
Mm-hmm. And I should ask you, too, about The Realist. You stopped it, what, in 1974?
Yes.
You stopped publication, and recently you brought it back out again in newsletter form, and I was wondering why.
Well, there was this feeling, you know, the fact that we had in the White House an after-dinner speaker and that people were so easily fooled by image rather than content, it was just an urge to do it again. The time, and most of the mail I got said the time is right again, so that was validation.
Mm-hmm. You started The Realist in 1958, and this was really before the underground press, or at least before the alternative press was given that name of the underground press. Why did you see a need for something like The Realist, for publishing the kinds of things that were either so radical or so bizarre that they wouldn't appear in the mainstream press?
Well, I had been doing freelance stuff for Mad Magazine and for the Steve Allen Show, and I just came in contact with more and more taboos. The first thing I did for Mad Magazine was a thing called If Comic Strip Characters Answered Those Ads on the Back of Magazines. And we had Dick Tracy getting a nose job, Alley-Oop getting rid of his superfluous hair. And we wanted to have Olive Oil sending away for falsies. And the publisher said, no, he didn't want to do that because his mother would object. And I said, yeah, but your mother's not a typical subscriber. And he said, yes, but she's a typical mother. And, you know, they had 250,000 circulation at that time. So there was really no humor for adults in this country, except for maybe cartoons and The New Yorker. This was before Doonesbury, before National Lampoon, before Spy Magazine, before Saturday Night Live. So I had a pretty clear field to say in print what I would say in the living room.
Well, it's one thing to want to start a magazine. It's another thing to actually pull it together and do it. How did you start? How did you finance it?
Well, I was working for a publisher named Lyle Stewart, who published a paper called The Independent, which was kind of a missing link or a forerunner of the underground press. I mean, there's been a tradition going back to George Seldes, in fact, I'd researched it all the way back to the 1890s when there was a publication called The Iconoclast in Waco, Texas. And so I worked out of Lyle Stewart's office and got a mailing list of a free thought magazine, which had 3,000 names to it, and offered them subscriptions and their money back if they didn't like the first issue. And we got 600 subscriptions to start with, and only one individual asked for their money back.
So tell me more about your vision for The Realist when you started it.
Well, I remember the first thing, I was still living with my parents at the time. I was publishing what was considered the hippest magazine in the country, and I was living with my parents. And I remember they were watching a telethon, and I suddenly blurted out, "This is barbaric." And they looked at me as if I were a Martian. And, of course, in their eyes, I was a Martian. And I think it was a kind of species, a need for community, for an extended family, so that I knew I couldn't be the only Martian on my block, or there was no hope. And so The Realist served as a kind of network for Martians all over the country. And the first thing I published, in fact, in 1958, was a child's primer on telethons called See the Tired Man, which talked about the contradictions of having the private sector raise money to cure leukemia while the government was exploding test atomic bombs which had fallout that caused leukemia.
Yeah, it was also in a way about how big celebrities exploit telethons for greater audiences to build their own reputation.
And the corollary to that is that the audiences come not even knowing what the cause is. So it's symbiotic.
So let's get back to you living with your parents while publishing this hip magazine. Why were you still living with them? Why didn't you move out into your own apartment?
Well, you know, sometimes it's easier to be courageous in print than it is with your own family.
Well, did it take that much courage to move out? Was the problem that you didn't have the money or that they wanted you to stay?
Well, actually, I tapered off from living them. I got a little apartment near my office, but I didn't tell them about it, and it had the same phone number, so they would just think that I was working late a lot of times.
Oh, so why didn't they want you to move out, though?
Well, it was just, you know, I remember I told my mother once that I was thinking of getting an apartment, and she said, why? And I said, well, I don't have any place to be alone with a girl, as they were called in those years. And she said, well, Dad and I will step into the other room. And I said, no, I mean really alone. And she went and she took a shower and came out and said that any girl who does that is a tramp. I mean, this was, you know, the late 50s, and we were a very puritanical culture. And it was just, it just caused a lot of emotional upset.
Did they think it would look bad if you lived alone and you weren't married yet?
I think they thought it would look as if it was their failure, in a certain sense, that I didn't stay with them.
Well, they must have thought it was pretty peculiar, all the material that you were bringing home and publishing.
My mother said to me, she said, you know more about birth control than I do.
In The Realist, you've never really differentiated between satire and journalism. So you'll have this really wacky piece that makes all kinds of impossible charges that's satire, but someone could read it and think it was real. And then you'll have an investigative story that someone might think was really a joke, but it's actually true. And I guess I'm surprised in a way that never got you into really serious trouble.
Oh, I think it's protected me in a way. I mean, first of all, I just never wanted to take away the pleasure from the readers of discerning for themselves whether something was actual or made up. And but I've tried to second guess attorneys. I mean, I never let an attorney read The Realist until it was published, so that then they could say, well, you shouldn't have done that.
right, but they can't stop it.
I did get sued once for calling another journalist a liar in print, and that did come to court, and I won because we were able to prove to the jury that he had indeed lied.
Let me read something that Mort Saul said to you in an interview that you did with him, and this is published in the anthology of The Realist, and I'll confess that I don't know what year you did this interview in.
That would have been, I think, probably 63, right before the assassination of President Kennedy.
Okay. So here's what Mort Saul says. He says, I think The Realist is probably the most vital publication in the United States, but I'm not giving fodder to any bigots when I say to you, I don't think the magazine should dissipate its time on crudeness, and I think there's an appetite in the magazine for crudeness. I think you're evading responsibility by making out that the whole world is a hoax, the whole world is a put-on, morality is a put-on. In other words, I think you confuse puritanism and morality. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I remember in talking to Mort Saul, I asked him about making so many jokes about integration, about segregation, rather, and he said, well, it's implicit that he's for integration. And I think, you know, if I would make fun of certain things, there would be between the lines, there, without being preachy, the standards were there, you know, in other words, if I would make fun of the laws against abortion, it would be fairly implicit that I was for free choice. And in fact, I went over the line as a journalist and became an underground abortion referral service during the 60s after publishing an interview with an anonymous abortionist. This started in 1962. There was an article in Look magazine about abortion, and in it they said that there was no such thing as a humane abortionist. And there was this, the late Dr. Robert Spencer was known around the nation as the saint because he helped pregnant women sometimes for $5 if that's all they could afford. He was in Ashland, Pennsylvania. And so I asked him for an interview. He happened to be a subscriber and told him that I would go to prison sooner than reveal his name. And so once I published it, I began getting calls from people who, even nurses in hospitals, who had no access to safe abortions.
Well, I want to talk with you about some more of your experiences, and I want to ask you about founding the Yippies and some of your experiences in the 60s, and then I want to find out what you've been doing recently. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Paul Krasner, who is the founder and publisher of the Realist, which is a radical magazine that he founded in 1958 and that he recently resurrected in newsletter form. He also co-founded the Yippies with Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. He now does a stand-up comedy act, which he describes as investigative satire. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Paul Krasner is my guest. You started The Realist before the 60s counterculture. So here we go with the big question. What was your first drug experience? How did you first start doing LSD or marijuana?
Oh, well, that came about. Actually, I had been publishing material defending the right to smoke marijuana and to take LSD before I actually did.
Uh-huh.
Robert Anton Wilson.
So you were defending
Wilson.
It on
again, the
as
right
a principle
to choice.
Before you, yeah, right.
As just an individual right. And Robert Anton Wilson had gone to Millbrook, the drug research center of Tim Leary and Richard Alpert and Ralph Metzner, and he had written an article for The Realist about it called calling LSD the a psychological H-bomb. And shortly after I published that, Tim Leary called me and invited me to come up to Millbrook in upstate New York. And I went there for and just started doing research on LSD. And after 6 months, not only reading about it, but also talking with these minds, figuring that if that was brain damage, I was willing to risk it. And then I took it at Millbrook. My guide was a man named Michael Hollingshead, who first introduced Tim Leary to the drug.
Mm-hmm. Was your first experience a good one?
It was strange because it was so good. I called up my wife, with whom I was separating, to thank her for providing this wonderful experience. And she kept telling me that, you're telling me you love me for something I didn't do. So it was very interesting for myself, who was publishing a magazine that had supposedly a rational basis, to be in such an irrational space. And it was a good learning experience.
Did you feel when you started doing a lot of LSD that your priorities changed, or that your worldview changed, what you wanted out of life was changed?
No, I think I had already, it just solidified it. I had a kind of atheistic outlook, and a lot of people had a religious experience with LSD, and I just found a larger variety of gods not to believe in.
You were one of the founders of the Yippies with Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, and it was you who actually coined the name. So why don't you tell us how you did it, how you came up with it?
Well, we were having a meeting. This was on the afternoon of December 31st, 1967, on the Lower East Side of New York at the home of Abby and Anita Hoffman. There were several of us there, and we were planning a festival of life to go as a protest to the Democratic Convention in Chicago that year, the coming year, 1968. And I, as a journalist, knew that reporters need the who for the who, what, when, where, and why. And I remembered that a few months before that, the Diggers, which were sort of psychedelic social workers in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury, that they had held a parade for the death of hippie because they felt that it had become such a media exploited term. So they wanted to be called Free Americans, which was, you know, you don't find people yelling, "Get a haircut, you lousy Free American." So I knew that it needed something else, and I started going through the alphabet, ippy, bippy, kippy, dippy, and was about to give up when I said yippy to myself and realized that that would be perfect, and then worked backwards to see what acronym that could come from.
Because everything has to be an acronym, right?
Well, just to give it an organic derivation, even though I was working backwards.
Uh-huh.
And so the letters Y, I, and P, yippies would derive out of that. And then again, working backwards, I saw that the words youth and international and party were so appropriate because it was a youth movement, it was international, and it was a party in both senses of the word.
How did you manage to be a founder of the yippies yet not get indicted in the Chicago conspiracy trial?
Well, I was one of the... They originally had a list of 20 that they were going to indict. A few of us, Bob Fass from WBAI in New York, and Ed Sanders, and Stu Albert, and myself, were all journalists, and the word was they didn't want to make it a First Amendment thing. And they reduced it to 8 who were the most visible, and also 8 cops had been indicted, so I guess that was the scales of justice being balanced.
You've written about how during the Chicago conspiracy trial you decided to drop acid before testifying, and what you decided to do was to, when you were sworn in, you decided to refuse to tell the truth?
Oh, well, no. The thing about LSD was that, like any catalyst for coming to grips with your subconscious, whether it's Aikido, Zen, yoga, meditation, LSD was a reminder that you're always making choices every moment. Even if action seems spontaneous, there are choices being made at the basis of it. And so I was so zonked out that when the bailiff said, "Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God," I said no, because I thought he was offering me a choice. But within the core of my reality, I knew, and then I then stated that I choose to affirm to tell the truth rather than swear in the Bible, which is my right under the First Amendment. So it was just it just happened very theatrically, but I remembered my lesson from civics class in junior high school.
When you look back on your experiences in the 60s and early 70s, are they experiences that you feel really glad you went through, that you or that you feel slightly embarrassed about now? I'm always interested in how people look back on the period.
Oh, no, I wouldn't have missed them for anything.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm not embarrassed. I guess Orson Bean reminded me the other day of something I guess I'm embarrassed about. He and I were on some TV show in Cleveland, and at that time my hair was extremely long, and I was wearing a hat most of the time, a floppy black hat. And we went into a Chinese restaurant before the TV show, and the waiter asked what the lady will have, meaning me. So I guess that I was embarrassed about that.
Let me ask you about the question of sexism. You were one of many people singled out as being an example of people in the cultural or political left who were sexist in the way that they thought about women or wrote about women. And I was wondering how feminism initially affected you and how you feel you've been changed by it.
Well, you know, I always thought I was a feminist, and I always thought I was super conscious, but there are always more and more layers of oneself to be revealed. And so, for example, what I thought was a joke that feminists would approve of at the time, this would have been in the late 60s, was about that there should be a rape-in of legislators' wives so that they could get impregnated, and then their husbands would vote for abortion rights. And feminists accused me of sexism in that because it said I was, you know, making victims of the legislators' wives when they hadn't done anything. And I had resistance at first. Nobody likes to be, you know, to have their material corrected, but I realized there was some truth to it and changed the material.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you know, you still have to remain true to yourself. I've gotten criticized for talking about the absurdity of turkey basters being used for artificial insemination. I haven't dropped that from my performances because I think that the absurdity of turkey basters transcends gender difference.
I'm sure in the 60s that you always wondered if you were followed by the FBI and what was in your FBI files. I don't know if you ever filed under the Freedom of Information Act.
No, I got my files.
You got your
FBI
files?
And my CIA files, both, yeah.
What's one of the most interesting things in your file?
I guess the most frightening was that in 1969, the FBI published and distributed anonymously a flyer which had on it a swastika, large swastika, and in each square of the swastika was a photo of Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman, Mark Rudd of SDS, and myself. And then the headline said, "Lampshades, lampshades, lampshades." And the copy underneath said that the only way that oppressed blacks would get rid of their oppression would be for the elimination of these Jewish leaders. And then the approval letter from the Washington office of the FBI said that the publication and distribution of this flyer should not be traceable to the Bureau. This flyer, which mentions which has the facetious suggestion for the elimination of these leaders. So I guess they were covering their tracks, though if anybody killed us, they could say, well, we said facetious. So that was the most frightening thing, that you know, that, and especially that it was being done with taxpayers' money.
Did you ever get rid of the paranoia that there was maybe somebody tapping your phone or following you?
Well, I tried to avoid the paranoia by having as a criterion that everything I said was on the record. And so I virtually had no secrets. Except perhaps the name of my marijuana dealer. But everything I did was really legal. There was one demonstration that I got arrested for, and they dismissed it for lack of evidence, and the judge started lecturing us, saying, next time, don't tempt fate. And I started arguing. I said, well, wait, is freedom of assembly tempting fate? And my lawyer jabbed me in the ribs and said, shh, quiet, this is my first case. Don't blow it for me.
You started publishing The Realist before the blossoming of the alternative press. What's your assessment of the alternative press today?
There's the alternative press, which is in so many cities, weeklies, which are distributed free and are supported by advertising. And there's a whole spectrum of them, and some of them are extremely political, and some of them are more fashion-oriented. But there's also an underground press, an alternative to the alternatives, which is developing. There are like maybe half a dozen in Boston alone. And I got a letter from a 14-year-old kid in Illinois who's starting his own paper called The Radical. So it's sort of like a replay of the 60s, but with a loss of innocence.
Okay. Well, listen, Paul Krasner, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Paul Krasner, who was the founder and publisher of The Realist. He founded it in 1958, recently resurrected it, and now publishes it in newsletter form. He now also does stand-up comedy weekly at the Odyssey Theater in Los Angeles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Herb Alpert. In the 60s, he had hits with his group, the Tijuana Brass. In the 80s, he was back on the charts with his record Rise and with Diamonds, which he recorded with Janet Jackson. Alpert is also the co-founder of A&M Records. In fact, he's the A in A&M. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. If you can't say something nice, say something surrealistic. A typical piece of advice from Zippy the Pinhead. Bill Griffith's comic strip character appears in newspapers and books, on calendars, and of course in Bill Griffith's mind. Coming up, we get a glimpse into that mind. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from the West Coast duo Was Not Was. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Gorillas in the Mist, starring Sigourney Weaver as Diane Fossey, the scientist who was murdered while working to save the mountain gorillas of Africa. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The crew of the Space Shuttle Discovery has deployed a communications satellite, the primary objective of America's first post-Challenger mission. The shuttle rocketed flawlessly into orbit today, returning the United States to manned spaceflight for the first time in more than 2.5 years. With uncharacteristic emotion, Hugh Harris, NASA's voice of mission control, counted down the final seconds to launch.
10, we're go for main engine start. 7, 6, we have main engine start. 3, 2, 1, 0, and liftoff! Liftoff! Americans return to space as Discovery clears the tower.
The 5-man crew of veteran astronauts blasted off at 11:37 Eastern Time this morning, about an hour later than originally planned because of unfavorable wind conditions in the upper atmosphere. The redesigned shuttle booster rockets fell away on cue, confirming that hundreds of modifications ordered after the Challenger disaster had paid off. Discovery sailed into orbit without a hitch. Back at Cape Canaveral, launch director Bob Seek told reporters launch team members could not control their emotions as the shuttle roared toward its mission.
They just couldn't help it when SRB separation occurred. There was a loud shout, I think, from everybody in the control room, but they very quickly settled back down as they remembered their training. But at the next milestone, they couldn't help it, and they shouted again.
Shouting erupted, too, among the tense thousands who gathered for miles around the Kennedy Space Center to watch the liftoff. The hijacker of a Brazilian airliner carrying about 100 people has been shot dead by police. Officials say the hijacker was gunned down as he left the commandeered Boeing 737 to board a smaller plane at an airport 150 miles from Brasilia. Before leaving the jet, the hijacker killed the plane's co-pilot and wounded 2 other people. Officials had described the man as mentally disturbed. The United Nations peacekeeping forces have won the 1988 Nobel Peace Prize. The Nobel Committee announced its decision today at a news conference in Oslo, Norway. The Peace Prize citation praised UN peacekeepers for voluntarily taking on demanding and hazardous service in trouble spots around the globe. Accompanying the Peace Prize is an award of $388,000. The committee said the money is intended to strengthen the authority of UN peacekeepers and the United Nations as a whole. The funeral of a prominent Palestinian in the Gaza Strip today turned into a major anti-Israeli demonstration. NPR's John Hockenberry reports.
79-year-old Rashad Shawa was a former mayor of Gaza and the patriarch of one of its oldest families. He died of a heart attack earlier this week. Thousands marched at his funeral today carrying PLO flags and chanting anti-Israeli slogans. Not everyone in the crowd mourned his passing, however. Younger radical Palestinians said they strongly disagreed with Shawa's consistently pro-Jordan views, while older Gazans said Shawa was at least someone you could take local problems to, something not true of the secretive leaders of the Intifada or uprising. Despite the bold display of numerous Palestinian flags and stone-throwing, today's funeral did not erupt into full-scale violence. Soldiers were restrained under orders, and as a result, there were only 4 or 5 minor injuries, in sharp contrast to the high number of injuries all of this month, many from controversial plastic bullets. The aim today was not to cause injuries, according to an Army officer on the scene, an aim that could change tomorrow, he said. I'm John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
Soviet officials today announced an urgent meeting of the nation's parliament on Saturday, following a meeting of the Communist Party Central Committee tomorrow. Few analysts believe the surprise meeting suggests political crisis. Stock prices were sharply higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 33 points to close at 2119.31. Advances led declines 5-2 on volume of 156 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 37 cents. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The West Coast duo Was Not Was has just released their third album. Like their first two, it draws on almost every musical influence of the day. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
So much of rock and roll in the 80s is about creating an identifiable sound and image that Was Not Was seems either radically refreshing or commercially suicidal. Here is a rock act in which the lead singers change regularly and are rarely the creators of the music. Those creators themselves use pseudonyms, and their collaborators range from Elvis Costello to Frank Sinatra Jr. At the same time, What Up Dog makes a mockery of eclecticism. The lyrics manage to parody the emptiness of most pop poetry as well as the pretentiousness of the stuff that aims to be proud and political. Though they couldn't have known at the time they recorded it, Was Not Was has turned out a rock version of Don DeLillo's current novel about Lee Harvey Oswald, Libra. It's a song called 11 Miles Per Hour, the Abe Zapruder version.
He learned how to kill at 11 miles an hour, such a deadly speed. 11 miles an hour, at the time and place of greed. They pulled their limousine down Elm Street, slow and green. Let the doctor shower at 11 miles an hour.
When you know a little about the fellows behind Was Not Was, some of their eccentricity acquires a context. The men behind the music call themselves Don Was and David Was. Don is a mystery to me, but I can tell you that David Was is really David Weiss, who used to work as a jazz critic at a newspaper in Los Angeles that also employed me about 6 years ago. Please consider this full disclosure of a possible conflict of interest. I also know that while they're not brothers, both Don and David grew up in Detroit, to this day still the home of the most racially and culturally diverse rock and roll ever created. This suggests to me why the Was Not Was boys make music that accommodates just about everything. Screeching hard rock and Ornette Coleman-style harmonics. Don plays the synthesizers, David plays the flute. Their range is staggering, yet offhand, and never smug. To take one notable example, the Wuzzes are very fond of jazz singers. On their previous album, called Born to Laugh at Tornadoes, they hauled in Mel Torme, no less, to velvet fog his way through a song called Zazz Turn Blue. In what in Was Not Was terms might be considered a bid for accessibility, on the new album they've asked Frank Sinatra Jr. to sing a composition called Wedding Vows in Vegas.
Plastic flowers in her hair, don't they make a lovely pair? Met last night at the slot machines, him in leather, her in jeans. All night preacher does the ceremony, his wife throws minute rice, her tears are phony. But wedding vows in Vegas aren't meant to last for ages. You've got to be courageous to play the odds that love will win, whatever city you're in.
A few cuts after that, Was Not Was throws you off with this kind of anti-song called Dad, I'm in Jail.
Hello, Dad.
Stuck in between those two numbers is a lovely collaboration between David Was and Elvis Costello. It sounds like a version of the Drifters' Under the Boardwalk with odd but finely detailed lyrics. It's called Shadow and Jimmy.
Shadow and Jimmy were always your
yesterday's news. Jimmy's a bowler, shadow rinses out his green bowling shoe. Late Friday night when the bars are all shuttered and dark, he shadows back Jimmy through the lot in the lost trail.
Clearly, Was Not Was is working on its own wavelength. They traffic in the sort of stuff that usually never works in a rock music context. Satire, irony, in-jokes. From Frank Zappa to Sha Na Na, the inclusion of these elements usually kills off whatever invigorating vulgarity made the music worthwhile to begin with. I think Was Not Was has managed to create a vital, messy artiness that works as good pop, if not necessarily popular, music.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's Walk the Dinosaur from the new Was Not Was album, What Up, Dog? This is Fresh Air. Bill Griffith draws his cartoon strip Zippy the Pinhead to keep from going crazy. It's his way of rechanneling the constant buzz of mass culture. Bill Griffith started drawing Zippy in 1970, first for Underground Comics, then for alternative newspapers. For the last 3 years, King Features has been syndicating the strip to 55 daily newspapers. If you've never seen Zippy, I'll describe him for you. His size, hulking. His age, somewhere between 14 and 35. He has a pear-shaped head topped with 8 hairs sticking straight up. He wears a large, flowing polka-dot muumuu and styrofoam shoes. Zippy speaks in a trail of non-sequiturs made up of useless bits of information. I'll let his creator, Bill Griffith, describe Zippy's personality.
Kind of like the remote control device on your TV set. Like the way you click it from station to station in a seemingly arbitrary, random fashion. But if you pay attention, it makes a kind of sense all of its own.
Well, Zippy doesn't only behave like my remote control. He's a real mass media sponge.
Television and reality kind of blur in Zippy's mind, as well as probably most people's. They just don't want to admit it. The characters in a TV sitcom are just as real to him as one's family members may be to you and me, and maybe a little more real.
Laundromats have a mystical place in Zippy's life. When he was campaigning for president, he talked about laundromat consciousness. And he once said, "Don't you realize that the end of the wash cycle is a treasured moment for most people?" What's this about laundromats for you, or for him?
Well, it's got to do with staring at the wash as it spins in the circular window of life, I guess. He sees things in the wash. He sees things that maybe other people don't see.
Other than his clothes.
Right. And don't forget, you meet interesting people in laundromats. Laundromats are like buses that don't move. You know, they're like everybody is in a laundromat at one time or another, and you can talk to them. It's a little easier, and you can observe them in their natural habitat a little better than you can in other public places. It's a kind of it's a kind of microcosm of life, you know. A laundromat is where everybody gets together in the old sense of you know, doing their laundry like people do. People used to do in the old days when they all came down to the river, I guess.
Now that you have your own washing machine, do you miss the ritual?
I must say I pay occasional visits to the laundromat with my sketchbook. I have to keep in touch with the real people.
One of Zippy's mottos, if that's the right word, is, are we having fun yet? And I was wondering how you came up with that, if you don't mind my asking you.
Well, like all Zippy sayings, it did not come easily to me. I think it started out with, am I having fun yet? And then it was, am I having fun? I tried it without the yet for a while. It took me a couple of months to perfect that. And now it's, of course, on bumper stickers coast to coast, for which I receive not 1 cent. But it's every cartoonist seems to contribute at least one phrase to the language, and maybe that'll be on my tombstone, you know, am I dead yet or whatever. It's a long tradition, and I'm glad I was able to give America a phrase with some deep resonance.
Well, I'll tell you what speaks to me about that phrase. You know how there's a whole population of people who insist that you have a good time?
Right. Well, Zippy's question is not meant to have an answer, of course. It's more of an existential statement. Right. Well, if you don't know, and you have to ask, there's no answer for you. There's no hope. It's more of a statement of condition than it is a question about fun or the lack of it. But I think when people put it on their cars, what they're trying to say is, where's the party, basically? Which, of course, is another existential question.
There's a character who I assume is your alter ego named Griffey.
Mm-hmm.
Would you describe the character and why you created him?
Well, Zippy is not enough for me. I need my own voice as well. Zippy can't spout crank opinions the way Griffey can and believe them. Griffey can believe in his opinions. Zippy slips in and out of them like costumes and a change of clothes. Zippy swims among his opinions, whereas Griffey holds tight to them. And I think that's he provides a kind of a George Burns to Zippy's Gracie Allen, I guess.
You started drawing Zippy in the early 70s, and that was still during the time of underground comics and the counterculture. And a lot of the underground comics really had a lot of, druggy kind of jokes, acid head jokes and pothead jokes and, you know, jokes about, you know, humor about being stoned all the time. Was it hard for Zippy to survive underground comics? I mean, to survive past underground comics, to outlive underground comics.
I suppose it was hard for any cartoonist that worked in underground comics to survive underground comics. It effectively died as a vibrant or vital medium in about 1974. I survived because I didn't take so many drugs. I don't know. Zippy was a voice that was inside me that I had to speak with. I didn't have much choice. I just kept doing it, and all I can figure out is that hard work got me through the mid 70s, and just it was a struggle. Yeah, I mean, there was a time from 73 to maybe 78 when doing Zippy was more of a need, a personal need of mine than it was anything else.
How does the Zippy of the days of underground comics compare to the Zippy of today, who's syndicated in dailies?
I don't think there's a hell of a lot of difference. I think it's a real evolution. You have to remember that though I am syndicated daily, and it's by King Features, probably the oldest and possibly the most conservative syndicate, if you look at their roster of strips, they came to me. They asked me to do a daily strip. I didn't knock on their door. But I figured, why not take advantage of it? And I said, well, you know, here's my list. I felt like the SLA. Here's my list of demands. Among them were that I keep my copyright. If you look carefully at daily strips, you'll see the only, to my knowledge, the only cartoonists and daily strip cartoonists that retain their own copyright are Gary Trudeau and yours truly, which to most cartoonists is not a big deal, but to me it was, because this is something I created, and I think of it as something that I'll probably be doing into my dotage, you know. Are we having old age yet? Are we having retirement yet? So So I thought it was important to keep my copyright. And I also said, you can't, you know, I mean, I do what I do. If this is what you want, this is what you're going to get. I'm not going to change it. I don't think I've ever, at least consciously, I've never tried to pander to an audience. I've never tried to tailor the work to anybody.
You started as a painter, and then you started doing comic stuff. What was responsible for the switch?
Seeing the first underground comics had a major effect on me in New York. I think I was basically suppressing. There was like a Milton Berle in me trying to get out, and he couldn't squeeze out through the oil paint tube. He couldn't fit. My work was, as a painter, was getting increasingly silly and goofy and unsaleable. I was starting to put balloons, word balloons, into my work. I guess I found my medium. It was one of those things where, as a kid, I was always interested in comics, and then I took a long detour through art school and fine art, and finally came back to what I probably always should have been doing.
You probably feel really privileged to be in places like newspapers now that lots of people read, as opposed to being confined to comic book stores or to art galleries.
Oh, yeah, it's a daily thrill for me to realize that Ronald Reagan is reading my strip in the Washington Post. You'll remember that in the early days of his first term, on the front page of it was here at least, I'm not sure it was all over the country, they printed his telephone doodles, and every one of them had a tapered, pointed head with little bow at the top and little hairs. I took this as a great compliment. And also, I think it was either during his first or second campaign tour, he was in New Orleans speaking to an audience of hard hat, you know, construction workers, and they presented him with, you know, a bronzed hard hat, and he held it up aloft and he said, "I'm sorry, fellas, I can't wear this. I'm a pinhead." This went out over the UPI wires, by the way. I'm not making these things up.
Bill Griffith has Zippy books and a Zippy screenplay, and now Zippy has a theme song.
Zippy!
What a baby boomer!
Zippy!
He's a real consumer. If the rinse cycle of sorrow is spoiling your day,
there's a polka dotted pinhead heading your way.
Yo!
Zippy!
Zip, Zippy!
He put the whiz in the cheek. His
life's a pain. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. How are you?
Following the flight of the shuttle?
We are. Our crew is still down there, Richard Harris, Ira Flato, and we'll be following its progress, which so far is going perfectly well. Also, we consider drug abuse today and the plan that some have to legalize presently illicit drugs. We also visit a drug-ravaged section of a suburban community right near Washington, D.C. And Verda Mae Grosvenor reports on a party they threw last night in Washington, D.C. at Union Station. Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, once again has what it always used to have, and that is a railroad station.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. By the time of her murder at her remote base camp in Rwanda, Africa, primatologist Diane Fossey had dramatically altered people's perceptions of the mountain gorilla that she had devoted her life to studying. Now a film about her remarkable dedication has just come out. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
I've had my doubts about Sigourney Weaver. The flat, preppy voice, the actressy mannerisms, and the habit she has of condescending to her characters. And all her flaws are on display in Gorillas in the Mist, but somehow the role she's playing transfigures them. As Diane Fossey, the amateur zoologist who virtually lived with Rwanda's mountain gorillas until her mysterious murder in 1985, Weaver works so hard and so daringly that she bursts the bonds of her limited talent. She's toiling to be her character. And by the end of the movie, you may find yourself thinking of Diane Fossey as a woman with a flat, preppy voice and actressy mannerisms. Listen to the way she sounds in this scene with Brian Brown, who plays the National Geographic photographer she falls in love with.
You know, I just can't imagine not being out with them every day. Seeing their faces, hearing them, smelling them. Every time I think I know everything there is to know about a gorilla, the next day something completely new happens.
That schoolgirl coyness, that eyelash-batting shallowness, all of it sounds odd coming from Diane Fossey. And that's especially true if you, like me, remember seeing Fossey in her Tonight Show appearances, a tough outdoorsy woman with an almost sexual yen for the great beasts she championed. Fossey's obsession was so deeply felt that she could make you feel it too, even as you also thought, this woman's a bit of a dingbat. And that's the effect Weaver's performance has. As she lives and works with the gorillas, Weaver's Fossey begins to adopt their characteristics. Her jaw juts. Her face grows impassively regal. Her walk takes on a kind of coiled weight. When she goes slightly mad, torturing the poachers who menace her apes, we feel torn. She's right to defend these noble animals, but she's clearly walking a precarious moral edge. All of this comes through in Weaver's performance, but not in the rest of the movie, which, truth to tell, is a piece of cheese. Maurice Jarre's soupy score clues us in on the movie's true character. Gorillas in the Mist is old Hollywood all the way. Everything that can be softened or compromised has been, from the throwaway love affair to the movie's vision of life on a remote African mountaintop, which looks only slightly less trying than a week at Camp Gitche-Gumee. The screenplay shies away from the most intriguing aspects of Fossey's story. What kept her up there with those gorillas, day after day, week after week, year after year? Was it something in her sexual or intellectual makeup, something in her philosophy or in her past? As ravishing and blissful as the director Michael Apted has made the girl meets gorilla scenes, they don't address these essential questions. Instead, the movie turns into a bleary-eyed paean to Fossey's heroism. She becomes the Albert Schweitzer of the simian kingdom, the great white Bwana who saves the helpless jungle dwellers. This movie is malarkey, but Sigourney Weaver's performance transcends it. Through her obsessive commitment to her character, you get a glimpse of Fossey's commitment to those gorillas in the mist.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I speak with investigative reporter Howard Cohn. It was Cohn who tracked down heiress Patty Hearst when she was on the lam. Cohn later investigated the Karen Silkwood story. His new book is a memoir about returning home to help his parents with the family farm, which he was once so anxious to leave. Also, critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews the photography of Nicholas Nixon, now on exhibit at New York's Museum of Modern Art. And jazz pianist Dick Hyman returns to perform and talk about the music of Teddy Wilson. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Ed Doherty, and Lisa Bruton. We had production assistance from Becky Thorne. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.